So this isn't supposed to be a finished job. It's a tryout of a set of ideas and a way of presenting things, which I'd very much like to hear from you a response to. So it really goes back to the question of our relations to the wider Buddhist world. What are the relations between our Buddhist movement and the rest of the Buddhist world? How acceptable is it for people in our movement to take teachings, to adopt practices from outside those that we regard as part of our own system of spiritual discipline? This has obviously become a question because a number of order members are taking teachings from outside the order and movement, and because we are in the process of shifting the mitra system so that mitras are not required not to shop around. And all of this raises questions about exactly what our responsibilities are, duties are, what our freedom is in relation to teachings and practices coming from outside the order. Bhante's gone into this, the principles that underlie this question, especially in his talk, Extending the Hand of Friendship. He's given the principles for the evaluation of teachings coming from different areas of the Buddhist tradition. But he hasn't gone at all into, how we are individually to decide what we take and how we take it and on what basis. In his talk, Looking Ahead a little way, which he gave at the Order Convention in 1999, he talked about the six distinctive emphases of the movement and order. And amongst these six distinctive emphases of the order is one that he refers to as the FWBO-TBMSG being an ecumenical movement. And in a way, this already says that insofar as we're in an ecumenical movement, well, we are open to the whole Buddhist tradition. So he says, I'll quote exactly what he says. In the first place, the FWBO-TBMSG is an ecumenical movement. Ecumenical is not really the best word in this connection, but there seems to be no other, at least not in English. The word signifies that, in principle, we accept the whole Buddhist tradition as it has developed over the centuries in the East. In principle, we accept the whole Buddhist tradition as it has developed over the centuries in the East. It means that we do not identify ourselves exclusively with any one Eastern sect or tradition. We learn from all, we appreciate all, and we are inspired by all. We study, as you know, Pali texts, like the Sutta Nipata, the Dhammapada, and the Udana. We also study the great Mahayana sutras, as well as works like the Songs of Milarepa and the Life and Liberation of Padmasambhava. At the same time, we study them critically. We do not accept necessarily as gospel everything, every word that they contain. We try to understand what they are getting at. We ask ourselves what they really mean, what they are trying to convey, what they are trying to communicate. And we try to apply that meaning to the extent that we are able to understand it to the living of our own lives as Buddhists. We try to apply that meaning to the extent that we are able to understand it to the living of our own lives as Buddhists. We have the same attitude towards the Buddhist tradition as a whole, that is to say, towards the Eastern sects and schools. Our attitude is one of critical appreciation. We do not necessarily accept them on their own terms, and we certainly do not confuse the Dharma itself with the various national cultures in which the various Eastern Buddhist sects and schools happen to be embodied. Above all, perhaps, we try to see what those sects and schools have in common with each other and with ourselves. This, in brief, is what I mean by what I call the ecumenical attitude of the FWBO-TBMSG. Well, presumably, if we do accept all these traditions and we try to learn from them, appreciate them, and be inspired by them, we are prepared to draw teachings and practices from them. That follows quite naturally. After all, can you learn from something if you don't take teachings from it, if you see what I mean? Can you be inspired by something if you don't practice it? So it seems to follow very directly from what Bhante says, that in principle we're prepared to draw teachings and practices from the whole Buddhist tradition. Of course, all of that is premised on the fact that we study them critically. We don't just take them on because they come from the Buddhist tradition. We evaluate them, we assess them, we look at them closely. We try to find out what they really mean, Bhante says. We try to apply the meaning, not merely the letter of what's said, but the underlying meaning of it. Yes, and our attitude is one of critical appreciation. Now this seems very important, very significant. We don't identify ourselves, Bhante says, with any particular school. It's of the essence of our own order that we do not identify ourselves with any one particular Buddhist school, but we are in principle open to all. And we are open to learning from and practicing from any of them. Presumably that also means that we don't consider that we've got a distinctive approach which is the unique understanding of the truth. We don't consider that within the order and movement we've got it all sewn up and everybody else has got it wrong or has only got it partly right. Presumably we consider ourselves to be Buddhists in the same sense that others are Buddhists. Bhante goes into this in extending the hand of fellowship. We may have particular quarrels with the way in which particular schools have put things, or consider that in the course of history the unifying principle has been lost sight of, at least in an explicit form. But we don't consider that there's no Buddhism outside FWBO, WBO, TBM, TBMSG. And therefore we are prepared to learn from the whole Buddhist tradition. So that implies that we need to engage with Buddhist schools outside our tradition in order to learn from them, to be inspired by them, and to appreciate them. You can't really learn, appreciate, and be inspired by something unless you really actively engage with it. So everything that Bhante says implies application to teachings and to practices. But I think what he says at the end of his discussion is the most important thing. Above all, perhaps, we try to see what those sects and schools have in common with each other and with ourselves. So the implication is that when we engage with teachings and practices outside those that we're generally accustomed to and that we consider part of our own system of spiritual discipline, we need to understand them deeply enough to see what they have in common with our own basic approach. I think the problem comes when we don't look deeply enough at teachings, where we apply them half assimilated, half understood, and without understanding where they, so to speak, meet our own approach. So, Bhante says that our approach is an ecumenical one, that we are, so to speak, open to the whole Buddhist tradition, that we have a critical appreciation of that tradition, and on the basis of that critical appreciation, we're able to learn from and be inspired by many aspects of the tradition. But in order to do that, we need to understand them deeply enough to understand what they have in common with our own particular approach. Presumably, once one's done that, there is no problem. Once you've understood what those teachings and practices have in common with the approach that the order and movements generally follows, well, then they easily assimilate to what we have. So, thus far, we've dealt with, so to speak, the broad principles following on from what Bante has to say about the ecumenical approach, which is one of the six distinctive emphases of the order and movement, according to Bante. But, of course, it doesn't. What we've said so far doesn't really draw out either the problems or the dangers or the method and how that is to be applied, how we are actively to engage in this appreciation, critical appreciation of the Buddhist world beyond the FWBO and WBO. But clearly, there's something of a warning in Bante's speaking of the need for a critical appreciation. All that's Buddhist is not Buddhist, you might say. All that goes by the name of Buddhism is not really the Dharma. One might even go further and say that all that is a genuine expression of the Dharma is easily understood from the point of view of our own times and our own system of spiritual discipline. So in the first place, we need to separate out what is simply deviant. Buddhism has attracted to itself over the years much that has very little to do with the Dharma, properly speaking. We also have to separate out what is merely cultural. Maybe beautiful, it may even be a very adequate expression of the Dharma within a particular cultural context, but it's not essential to the Dharma, so we have to be able to separate that out. Having done that, then presumably we also need to be able to relate what we're approaching to our own understanding and approach. And that means quite a bit of work needs to be done, quite a bit of thought needs to be given to it, quite a bit of discussion needs to take place, and quite a bit of experience needs to be accumulated. If we don't have that sort of critical appreciation, and that careful assessment of teachings and practices from the wider Buddhist tradition, the danger is that our order loses its coherence. As order members apply themselves to a wider and wider range of interests and practices from outside, from the wider Buddhist tradition, it becomes harder and harder to see what we have in common. We speak less and less a basic common language, so that we begin to reproduce the divergences that there are within the Buddhist world. And whilst there is generally within the Buddhist world a sort of polite acceptance of each other as belonging to a common world, there's a great deal of incomprehension and unspoken mistrust. And I think that you could expect, if there wasn't a careful process of assimilation, a careful process of critical appreciation, that order members would tend to find themselves specialising more and more in particular sectional interests. So you begin to have Zen chapters, if you like, and Vajrayana chapters, or Nyingma chapters, or chapters devoted to a particular bodhisattva, even centres devoted to particular sort of approaches and practices and teachings, and it become increasingly difficult to see what they all had in common, because they wouldn't have assimilated their particular approach sufficiently to a common basic understanding. So if one has any appreciation and places any value upon the spiritual unity of the order and movement, that critical appreciation and careful assimilation must be extremely important. The one thing that I know Bante was very much against in the founding of the order was the order simply being what the previous Western Buddhist order had been, which was basically a sort of professional body for Buddhist teachers. When Robert Stuart Clifton, I think that's the right name, started the Western Buddhist Order, the earlier Western Buddhist Sangha, in the 50s and 60s. What he really saw it as was a way of giving all Buddhist teachers a qualification that everybody would understand. So Bhante was, without having applied, made a member of the Western Buddhist Sangha. And it was the understanding was that you'd have Zen Roshis who would be members of the Western Buddhist Sangha, and Theravadin Bhikshus who would be members of the Western Buddhist Sangha. So there would be a sort of recognisable overarching qualification. So it was seen very much in those sort of professional terms. And whilst we may feel that we're a very long way from that, one can imagine that if we begin to simply take on teachings and practices in an insufficiently critical way, we would begin to just form a number of different sanghas at best, and at worst, simply a kind of umbrella organisation for Buddhist teachers. So if we want a genuine spiritual community, it's of the utmost importance that our approach to the wider Buddhist tradition is a critical one, in which there's careful assimilation and a reference all the time to the common underlying spirit and body of teaching which we hold in common. So those who do explore teachings and practices beyond the order and movement need to do a great deal of work to assimilate. They've got themselves to understand the teachings and practices deeply enough to see what they have in common with what we already understand, and thereby to be able to so to speak, assimilate it in practice, so that others will be able to see it as part of a single body. All our teachings and practices do cohere. They all do have both a theoretical unity and a spiritual unity. They all hang together. If we don't engage in that sort of active process of assimilation through careful and intelligent exploration, then we will lose our coherence. So yes, it seems to me that the heart of the issue is investigating teachings and practices deeply enough to see through one's own experience what they have in common with what we already understand. That means being able to sort of trace the theoretical lines between the way we understand things and the way those teachings are presented. So one can sort out the very divergent accretions of theory which the practices are set, and be able to show how they all come back, for instance, to the basic principle of going for refuge to the three jewels. And at the same time, one needs to be able to have touched the kind of spiritual essence of those teachings through experience, to be able to, in experience, re-communicate them from the perspective of our own system of spiritual discipline. So it's not a question of just seeing a superficial resemblance, you know, reading a book and deciding that that teaching really belongs within the order. It's a question of engaging with it deeply enough to understand it both theoretically and practically, to see what its point of identity is with what we already understand and practice. So that seems to me to be the task that faces us, and those are the dangers that face us. If we do not engage in that task sufficiently assiduously, the danger is that the order loses its spiritual coherence and becomes simply a congeries of interest groups, perhaps at best sort of spiritual communities that are increasingly divergent from each other, at worst that are just clubs. And the counter to that is a very deep exploration and a touching of the point of identity of those teachings and practices with what the order takes as its central basis. But how is that to be carried out in practice? Is it that each of us just goes off and explores on our own? Well, I think that here probably there's a rough and ready guide to be found in the level at which one's involved with our movement. And here I'm taking the conversation wider than simply the order. And I want to explain this because we are altering the criteria for becoming a mitra. In fact, we're saying we don't have criteria, but becoming a mitra is going to be a matter of making declarations, three declarations. Those declarations do not include a commitment to not, to use that dreadful term, which I'm glad to say is passing out of tradition, shopping around. We're not requiring that mitras do not shop around. That is where we're rapidly moving to. I think we're almost there. And I take it that within a few months, mitras will not be required not to shop around. So it's quite important to understand then what place what used to be called shopping around or not shopping around has in the overall economy of the movement. So let's go through it bit by bit and see then where that relates to what I've already said about the need for, or Bhante says, about a critical appreciation of teachings and practices from the wider Buddhist movement. So yes, of course, those who are not mitras, well, we can hardly say what we think they can or can't do. They can do whatever they like, and they do, by and large. And what we're saying now is that we think that it's quite all right for those who become mitras on the basis of these three declarations do go to practices and teachings outside our order and what our order and movement has to offer. In fact, I'd go so far as to say myself, I think it's probably no bad thing that people do go to teachings and practices from outside what our order and movement has to offer. After all, to use the shopping around analogy, probably you're going to get better product loyalty if people have tried other products first. Brand loyalty. We won't push this analogy too far. I'm sure it breaks down after a very few breaths. But in some ways, it's true. I think quite often people buy the FWVO, so to speak, without ever having even realised that there was any alternative. And whilst for most of us that's all right, for some people it leaves a certain uneasiness and perhaps a false expectation of the order and movement. Perhaps it's better if people have looked around a little bit and just know roughly what there is. I wouldn't exactly sort of send somebody off to do it, but I wouldn't discourage anybody who wanted to do it, because I think that once they do decide that they want to involve themselves fully and deeply with our movement, it's on the basis of at least some genuine knowledge of the alternatives. So yes, I don't myself think it's a bad thing if mitras on the basis of the three declarations do look around at other movements. It's not a problem for us, and it may even be a strengthening for us, because I'm sure they'll often find that, well, actually what they want is here, and so they'll probably be a bit more ready to realise that it's here even though we're not perfect. So that's as far as those who are mitras on the basis of the three declarations are concerned. But it seems to me that once you ask for ordination, or once somebody asks for ordination, the situation changes. If what we're saying is that this exploration, this critical appreciation, is desirable and possible, we need to take into account that it involves seeing what the point of identity is between what's being explored and the basic position of the order and movement. So can you really engage in that critical appreciation and that dialogue, you might say, with practices and teachings outside the order if you don't really understand fully and deeply the position that we have within the order? So it then seems to me that logically it follows quite simply that those who've asked for ordination should focus themselves on the practices and teachings that are on offer within the order. And in that way, they'll be better able to fully assimilate that perspective, the perspective which will give them later the possibility of looking more broadly. You can't really see what the identity of one thing is with another unless you've understood what the identity of the former is, if you see what I mean. You can't compare apples with pears if you've never seen an apple. Particularly if you've never eaten one. I think it works. I think it does work. But anyway, we'll leave it at that. All analogies have their limitations. Yes, it's very difficult to really know whether something is to be assimilated to something else unless you know the thing that it's to be assimilated to. And that, to me, implies a very deep knowledge and experience. And that is best gained by focusing for a period of time. Now, at the same time, I would say that it's not impossible to prepare oneself for ordination whilst engaging in teachings and practices that derive from outside the order and movement. It's not impossible. The problem is that it's very difficult for those who have to assess you and prepare you to engage with that. Because for them to engage with you and to assess whether you're ready for ordination and to assess that you do understand deeply enough the principles and practices of the order and movement, well, they're going to have to get to know, well, they're going to have to get to know you. They're going to have to get to know you in your practice of the teachings and practices of the order. But they're also going to have to get to know and understand these teachings and practices that you're doing from outside the order, with which they may not be familiar. So what you're doing is imposing upon your poor private preceptors, public preceptors, ordination team members, the burden of getting to know perhaps an increasing number of teachings and practices which derive from outside the context of the order and movement. Which means, of course, that they will have to engage in this critical appreciation of those teachings and practices. So I would say that whilst it's theoretically possible for somebody to prepare for ordination whilst basing themselves upon teachings and practices that are not part of the spiritual system of spiritual discipline that we have within the order and movement, it would be extremely difficult for those who are trying to assess you. And I think that it is therefore most intelligent to say that, generally speaking, those who have asked for ordination should simply concentrate on the teachings and practices which are common within the order and movement. Otherwise, I think one puts private preceptors, public preceptors and ordination team members under an intolerable burden. I should also say that I think that in focusing in that sort of way, it's not as if you're sort of closing off possibilities, spiritual possibilities to people. It's not as if you're sort of not permitting them to develop ethics or not allowing them to develop a deep understanding of the three lakshanas, or not allowing them to develop dhyana, or not allowing them to develop into reach into deep communication. I think that within our own body of teachings, really everything is there. But it may be that in certain cases one gets a particular insight, one gets a particular approach, one's own approach is refreshed, or one gets new insights from going more widely. But I don't think that in the short to medium term anybody is going to find a barrier to their spiritual development because they're just focusing on practices from within the order and movement. If it was the case that they were finding a barrier, it would probably be for psychological reasons, for some sort of inability to relate to teachings and practices, which I'm sure that if they worked with them, they could get over it. Or it could be it would mean there was a severe limitation and even distortion within the order and movement. So I don't myself think that in asking people who've asked for ordination to focus upon the teachings and practices that we have within the order, we would be doing them a spiritual damage. And indeed, I think we would be doing them a spiritual service. We'd be giving them the basis for approaching the wider tradition later on if they had felt the need to do so. Of course, it also has to be said, they still have a choice. Because they have a choice not to engage in the process of preparation for ordination. I think this is one of a myth of freedom that we have to keep remembering, that if you ask people to restrict themselves if they want to do something, you are not restricting their freedom, because they have the freedom not to do what you're offering them, if you see what I mean. If you ask people, if there are two doors, one on the left and one on the right, and you ask people to hop through the door on the right, only to come through the door on the right if they hop on their right foot, well, they don't have to go through it. It's up to them. Okay, it went down about as flat as the apple. <didn't it? laughs> So it seems to me, at least, that in general, it would be far better if those who are preparing for ordination just focused on the teachings and practices that we offer within the order. And that if they do not do that, that will inevitably prolong their preparation for ordination until such time as those who are likely to be their private preceptors or public preceptors or ordination team members have been able to investigate what it is they're doing and see where its point of identity is with what we are already doing. And that may be quite a long time, and I don't think there's any compulsion upon them to do so. Their interests may not lie in that direction. They may have quite a lot else to do anyway. So, yes, in general, I would say that those who have asked for ordination can reasonably be asked to focus upon our own teachings and practices. That certainly is my own view, and I think that it's probably fairly logical. Now, once people have been ordained, you haven't got much of a hold on them, we've noticed. They do whatever they want. They sometimes take a bit of time about it, but sooner or later they get round to it. And, of course, that's a jolly good thing. And you've got no way of sort of blackmailing them or threatening them or anything like that. Not that we want it. But yes, obviously, whilst people are preparing for ordination, well, you can say to them, if you want to be ordained, then we ask you to focus. After they've been ordained, well, you've got nothing that you're offering them. And anyway, they're members of the order. The order is a free association of individuals, etc., etc. So we don't even want to sort of control people in that kind of way. So what happens after people have been ordained? Well, of course, that they could, if they wanted to, start to explore more widely on the basis that I've already mentioned. However, I would recommend that people did not rush into that sort of exploration, and that one considered that at the same time as it's taken some time to really imbibe the spirit of the order and the movement in one's preparation for ordination, once you've been ordained, you've still got quite a lot of assimilating to do. Before you're ordained, you're assimilating, so to speak, from the outside. Once you're ordained, you're assimilating from the inside. And there's quite a lot to get used to. There's quite a lot to get to understand through practical involvement. And I would suggest that most people would be best advised to stick to the order's basic teachings and practices at least for the first 5 years after they've been ordained. You know that we've been beginning to talk in terms of an analogy with the Nisaya period of bhikshu ordination, that for the first 5 years the newly ordained bhikshu is dependent upon his teacher, as it's put. Unfortunately, the dependence is largely defined in economic terms, and we're not talking about that. It should be stressed. Don't make any mistake about that. Yes, we think it's a good idea if for the first 5 years after an ordination, the private preceptor thinks that, well, he needs to keep in very close contact and to really be making sure he knows and understands what the person he's ordained is up to, how their spiritual practice is going, and quite a close connection in that sort of way. And the person who's been ordained in those first 5 years would be well advised to discuss major experiences, major decisions, and the general direction of spiritual life with his private preceptor at the very least. So without turning the idea of nisaya into something too rigid or formulaic or formalistic, we think that it's probably sensible for people to think that in that first 5 years they need a close connection with their private preceptor, and the private preceptor needs to think in terms of making sure he has got enough time to keep that connection alive. And of course, one would be well advised during that period to make sure that before you took any major decision, you took the advice of your private preceptor, your Kalyana Mitras, your chapter, and so forth. After that, I think that probably most people would be advised still to be very cautious. You need a fairly hard head to explore more widely. And you need to be able to think critically. I have been quite appalled recently at a number of incidents where order members have taken something that, as it happens, I have said in the most literalistic sort of way. You take what you say and they kind of take a single word from what you said and run with that, instead of sort of understanding the spirit behind what you said. I'm sure everybody's had that sort of experience. Bhante, I know, used to complain about it a lot. Well, you need to be not literalistic in order to really have a critical appreciation of teachings and practices that are new to you, that come from outside the order and movement. So you need to have developed a spiritual critical faculty to a point at which you're able to look at things in an intelligent and spiritually sensitive way. And I think that doesn't come necessarily very readily to everybody very early on. And not because one's a bad person or not a good order member or whatever, but just because that sort of faculty hasn't been called upon. So I think probably one needs to know a little bit that one has got that critical ability. And perhaps one needs to be working on it in relation to other people. If you see what I mean, you need to be working with other people, you need to be studying with them, you need to be discussing with them, so that you're understanding more and more fully and deeply the principles and practices that you've already got. Then you can begin to look at others. But that said, yes, there is a great value in looking beyond the practices that we have. There's a value for the individual. Sometimes the direction of one's own sort of spiritual life leads one to sort of gain a certain inspiration from other sources. I've certainly found this myself. Something I've read, something I've heard, something I've learnt from somebody else has refreshed and inspired and opened up my own spiritual practice. So as an individual, one can be very much benefited by teachings and practices that come from beyond what we already know and practice. Collectively, of course, it can be of great benefit to us because, well, our order and movement do not exhaust all the possibilities of spiritual life. Spiritual life is endlessly various. You remember the Buddha and the parable of the Sinsapa leaves. He picked up a handful of leaves and asked if they were few or many compared with all the leaves in the forest around him. Of course, the disciples said they were few. And so he said, well, in just the same way, the teachings that I've shown you are few compared with those I have not shown you. So there's a vast array of spiritual teachings already within the Buddhist tradition, and many, many more that could yet come. I suppose it's because, in the end, spiritual life is utterly unique to the individual. every one of us is a completely fresh flowering of the spiritual path. And the spiritual life, the spiritual teachings and practices apply uniquely to us. So that there can never be one set of teachings that completely satisfies and defines everything that everybody will experience. I like that sort of Mahayana idea of hundreds of thousands of samadhis, that there are endless possibilities of meditational states, which each bodhisattva sort of explores his own samadhi range. So that range will be increasingly explored by us as time goes by. And that increasing range will allow us to reach increasing ranges of human beings. Human beings are so various, and they respond in such different ways. What appeals to you won't appeal to somebody else. So that the more versatile we are as a movement, as an order, the more we'll be able to respond to the spiritual needs of the vast numbers of human beings. So this exploration beyond what we presently have, I think is a very valuable process. But it needs to be done intelligently, it needs to be done sensitively, and it needs to be done with regard to the underlying unity of the order and movement. One has to look for what that teaching and practice has in common with the basic position of the order and movement, both doctrinally and in spirit. And one has to be able to, in one's own experience, perceive that underlying point of unity and identity, and one has to be able in one's communication to convey it to others. So that means that once one has a reasonable degree of soaking in the spirit of the order and in its basic position, one can explore. Perhaps to begin with, one explores by oneself or with a small number of other order members, keeping closely in touch with one's own preceptors and Kalyanamitras, letting them know what one's doing, filling them in on what you experience. And when you consider that you've explored deeply enough to understand the point of identity, the point that they have in common with what you already know and practice, well then you can begin to incorporate that into your approach. Perhaps you can even begin to teach it to others in the order. I think that probably is best done when one's discussed that very fully with senior members of the order, especially your own Kalyanamitras and teachers, just so that your assimilation is tested and you're required, so to speak, to put it to proof by explaining it and by demonstrating it to those who have the wit to test you. And then on that basis, well, one could begin to offer it to other order members. What happens beyond that, I think, is a little bit more doubtful. And in a way, I think that probably we're not yet ready to go any further. At the moment, our teaching at the level of pre-ordination is fairly homogeneous, is fairly unified. We have a fairly well laid out system. We teach the mindfulness breathing and the metta bhavana and so on. So we know fairly much what you're going to do when you go to any particular centre. And we of course can take refreshment from other sources. You may find that something you've learnt from another source makes the mindfulness of breathing that much easier to understand, makes it go much deeper, or whatever. But I think that if one's beginning to think about communicating new teachings and new practices, especially outside the order, probably for the time being, it's best to stop, to wait. I don't think we're ready to do that. I think that would have a fissiparous tendency and would tend to divisiveness and misunderstanding. What happens in the future, I'm not sure. I haven't yet found it easy to think my way through this. You know, is it that one day one would find some order members teaching, to beginners in a particular way, which was quite different from the way in which other order members taught to beginners? Some people might introduce beginners to meditation, which was much more based on, a non-formal approach. Others might continue with mindfulness and metta and so on. That would be one way in which things could develop. Whether that's desirable or not, I'm not yet really sure. I think there are a lot of difficulties with that. On the other hand, there are a lot of difficulties if you have order members doing a range of practices, but not feeling free to communicate those to others. So my own feeling is that for the time being, we should assimilate what is really a rather more expanded vision of what is open to an order member to do. It's been implicit all the time that order members can look more widely than the teachings and practices that we have, and indeed people have done that. But it's only relatively recently that order members have been doing it in a more open and obvious way. And perhaps the sort of clarification that I'm trying to engage in now is something a bit new for us. So perhaps we need to sort of assimilate that fully and try to see where that leaves us before we try to apply it to our approach to teaching outside the order. That would be my suggestion. It's not that we're necessarily at the moment closing the door to changing the way in which we teach outside the order, but I don't feel at the moment that we're ready to really have that discussion. Others might disagree with me, but that's my own view. I don't know how to think about it myself, and I think that's because we're not quite at the point where we can think about it. So I think it'd be far better if we just sort of took stock, well, assimilated fully, a somewhat expanded vision of where order members can derive their inspiration and practice, and we'll see where that leaves us, and then begin to debate how we go forward from there. There are all sorts of problems that centre chairmen and so on would have to face if there was suddenly a wide range of different teachings. It would be very difficult to run retreats that were really for, you know, anybody from anywhere. Padmaloka would find that some people were doing one sort of practice and other people were doing another sort of practice. How would you kind of integrate it all? So I certainly think that for the time being we should just stick with the practices and the approaches that we've got, perhaps refreshed by one's own deepened experience, which may come from one's inspiration from outside what we already count as part of our system of spiritual discipline. So are there any limits to this process of exploration? If order members are free, so to speak, if that's quite the right word, to explore more widely once they've really got themselves deeply embedded in the order, and once they're able to apply a critical appreciation, are there any limits? Well, I think that there are three rough and ready limits, which perhaps are still a bit not particularly sharp, but maybe it never can be very sharp. And I've thought of these in terms of limits imposed by relationship to each of the three jewels. So as regards the Buddha, there's a limit in terms of the teachings that you take, teachings and practices that you take on, in the relationship that those teachings and practices give you to whoever is teaching them. So for instance, if in taking on particular teachings and practices from outside our usual collection, you come into a relationship with a teacher, let's say even say a guru, that becomes more significant and vital to you than your relationship with your preceptors and your Kalyanamitras within the order, then clearly you've begun to drift out of the order. So, if you see what I mean, that's as regards the Buddha refuge. As regards the Dhamma refuge, well, if you take on teachings and practices that are embedded in an understanding of spiritual life that is in direct conflict with the central position of the order and movement, well, then clearly you've passed over the boundary. So, for instance, if you took on a fourth refuge or got rid of one of the refuges, to be a bit trite about it, that would clearly conflict. And if you go for refuge to Jesus Christ, well, then you can't go for refuge to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, not at least in my understanding. I'm sure that you could find a point of identity if you try really hard. More sort of seriously, perhaps the problem arises when you, if you take on teachings that you consider to be higher than other teachings. For instance, if you consider that you're taking on tantric teachings which supersede the going for refuge. If you do not see the teachings that you're taking on as expressions of the basic act of going for refuge, well, then you come into conflict with one of our distinctive emphases, and in fact the distinctive emphasis of distinctive emphases. Surely, if the order means anything, it means that going for refuge is central to spiritual life. So if you, not just central, but all-encompassing, it's always present at every level of practice, and it's present in every dimension of spiritual life. Well, if you believe that the teaching that you're taking on or the practice that you're doing belongs to something that supersedes going for refuge, well, then you've departed from the common understanding that we have. You've moved outside the order. Finally, as regards the Sangha refuge, if in the hard form of it, as it were, you join you take on an ordination, you really effectively join another ecclesiastical body. You cease to be a member of the order because you've joined another order. In the soft version of that, where you begin to feel a stronger loyalty to your fellow practitioners from outside the order than you do to your fellow practitioners within the order, at that point you've passed over the boundary. So these are the outer limits of that exploration, where you come into a relationship, whether formal or informal, with a guru, which supersedes your relationship with your teachers, preceptors and teachers, where you take on teachings that contradict the fundamental point of view of the order and movement, and where you join ecclesiastical bodies or drift into a spiritual fellowship with others outside the order that supervene your membership of the order. These are the limits of that exploration. And probably everybody needs to be careful of that when they're making these explorations. Because what can easily happen is that your exploration, well, it just sort of takes you over. And you just find yourself going further and further and losing more and more of a sense of your connection with the order and with your teachers and friends within the order. And the lines of connection become more and more attenuated without your really realizing it, because it happens just step by step, day by day, and a point comes where you realize that actually where you now are is more important to you than where you were. Probably on the whole, at that point one will realize that one's passed outside the order. I think it'll be very seldom necessary to tell somebody you've gone too far, unless they take ordination or take tantric initiation or something like that. So I think that the danger is that in that sort of exploration you don't really remain conscious of what you're doing and don't maintain a sufficiently strong connection with your own teachers. I should say that Bhante made it clear that if you do I'll come on to that a bit later. So yes, the exploration can take place, but there are limits to it, and the great issue is to make sure that you maintain a strong connection within the order and a consciousness of what's happening. Bhante said that probably what you need to be careful of is that your centre of gravity doesn't shift outside the order. It's a bit of a sort of vague term, but you probably get the message that you sort of feel really that you're no longer within the order, that you're somewhere else. And I've recently been looking at this with some people. that they've sort of formed connections that are stronger than the connections they've got within the order. And the question then becomes, well, are they within the order or not? It's a question for them, by and large, but it's a definite transition that takes place. And if you care about the order, if you believe in what the order stands for, well, you need to be careful that that very subtle sort of emotional, spiritual shift doesn't take place. Bhante spoke about all this in terms of possible sort of levels of engagement with teachings and practices from outside the order. For instance, he talked first of all about reading books. Well, it's not that every time you lift up a book you have to be really careful that you don't drift outside the order, or that anybody spotted reading Thich Nhat Hanh is drummed out of the order immediately. Their case are broken over their knee. Not at all. And what we really need to do is probably cut our teeth on books and learn that critical appreciation. We should be, of course, critically appreciative of everything we read, whether from within the order or outside it. Perhaps we need to do this a great deal more than we do. We need to critically appreciate the books that we read, but we're not being disloyal or moving outside the order in reading beyond the literature of the order. And we should think before we teach what we're coming across. We shouldn't just sort of spout it out before we've really fully sort of understood it and assimilated it. So yes, books are not really a problem. Probably every one of us reads more widely than the order's literature. And the main thing there is that we are critical in our reading, in the best sense of the term, critical. The second thing is, of course, going to lectures and retreats. You know, you just see that a Buddhist teacher is in town, you go along to a lecture. It's probably not much different to reading a book. And here, perhaps, it's again just a question of a critical appreciation, trying to see what the chap is really saying and trying to work out what there is in common with what we've got to say, trying to see where there's divergence, trying to see where the problems are, and so on. Retreats are a little bit of a further step, but again, as long as you've got quite a deep experience of the order, you can from time to time go on a retreat to learn some new method or whatever. But on the whole, I'm talking here of something fairly casual, where you're not sort of really going out of your way to seek new teachings and so on. You just want to know what's going on. You're just interested in sort of testing what you've got against other things. The next level is where you decide to really take on the systematic study and practice of teachings and practices coming from outside the order, where you deliberately go to a teacher or a group and you decide to follow it through. Here, I think you probably need to make clear your position, if it seems at all necessary, to those you are going to for teachings. Bhante said that, for instance, if you are really asking somebody to give you teaching and guidance, perhaps in meditation, well, you need to come clean with them. You need to sort of say, well, I am a member of the Western Buddhist Order. I'm not going to join your order. Even if there's some sort of initiation, I don't understand that as taking you as my guru in a sense of something that supervenes my relationship to my own teachers. They might find that a little hard to understand, but at least you need to have the courtesy to explain that to them and give them the option to say, well, no, I only want people who are going to be my disciples. What you're really saying is, well, yes, of course, you are my teacher in the sense that you're teaching me something in the ordinary sense of teaching, but I'm not going to take you as my sort of spiritual teacher as in the sense of a guide and even guru. And I'm not going to join whatever organization you may have. So I think that one needs to do that courtesy. One also needs to make it clear to your own teachers and preceptors what exactly you're up to. Bhante did say that, for instance, in the case of even tantric initiation, that could be allowable so long as it was very clear what the terms were under which you were taking it. Tantric initiation has an implicit sort of vow connection with the teacher, which is obviously usually honoured in the breach rather than the observance. But you need to in honesty, communicate that you're not taking it in that sense. And if the person doesn't like that, well, he will say, I'm sorry, you can't do it. Well, you have to go along with that. But probably they won't really quite understand what you're talking about, or they'll just say, that's fine. But the main thing is you need to have it clear with everybody what the terms are upon which you're entering into the relationship of learning. And you need to make sure that it's quite clear that this does not at all compromise your relationship to your teachers and your membership of the order. And you need to be very careful you don't get sort of drawn into either implicit commitments or subtle explicit ones. But yes, there's no reason why one shouldn't engage in that kind of systematic study. I wouldn't by any means advise everybody to. I think it's probably something for a minority of order members to engage in. And very much with a view to really critically appraising what they're studying and learning, and seeing what its point of identity is with what we already have. The fourth step is a step too far. That's where you explicitly and formally enter into a relationship with a teacher as your guru, or where you enter an ecclesiastical corporation in the sense of joining an order by taking ordination. If you're ordained as a Theravadin monk, if you're ordained as a Gelong or whatever, you've left the order in that act. And if you take tantric initiation without having clarified the relationship that you have with the teacher, then you've left the order. So that's the step too far in the quite formal sense. I should point out, for the sake of posterity, that if you take Christian orders, you've also left the order. Well, we did have somebody who was a bishop wanting to join the order, but that's another matter. It's absolutely true. He couldn't see why he shouldn't be a bishop and a member of the order. I'll tell you the story in private sometime. So again, we can follow all that through in terms of the levels of involvement in the movement. Friends and mitras, well, they can do what they like. Once somebody's asked for ordination, well, of course, they can read whatever books they want. They can go to the odd lecture just sample a little bit in that sort of way. They need to be a bit careful that doesn't become an interest which becomes a problem for those who are trying to help them prepare for ordination, because they've got to understand what they've filled their heads with in order to sort it out. And I would say that period probably needs to continue for the 5 years or so of Nisaya, that one is still basically restricting what one does to just reading a book, going to a lecture, that sort of thing. And certainly that one, whatever one does do, one keeps in contact with one's preceptors and Kalyana Mitras. Post-Nisaya, then, well, yes, if you feel that you are in a position to do so, if you have the critical faculties to do so, well, then one can start to explore. Of course, one thing you need to be really careful of is not just restlessness. Sometimes spiritual practice does become a bit dry, and it's not necessarily refreshed by just going to another practice. Sometimes people come and say, I'd like to take on a new visualization because the other one's gone dry. I remember Bante always saying, that's not the reason. It must be because, in a sense, your present practice is so alive that it's sort of moving in a new direction. So I think that needs to be the spirit of it, that something sort of unfolded a bit for you. And you, in order to get more deeply into what is unfolding, well, you need some guidance from beyond what is available to you within the order. So it should be coming out of fullness rather than out of boredom or flatness or dullness in general. And it certainly shouldn't be just a restless craving. Yes, so one should do it without compromising one's commitment within the order, in touch with one's preceptors and Kalyanamitras and chapter, and consciously assimilating, critically evaluating, and consciously assimilating, seeing what that teaching and practice has in common with the basic position of the order. I should say, I don't think there's any need to. One has a need to talk about all this because some people want to do it. But I don't think it's a question of saying that everybody's got to do it. You will go out and explore. There's no need to. And probably the great majority of people, it's a bit of an irrelevance. Maybe even worse than an irrelevance, a distraction. Most people can quite safely just stick to what the very considerable and rich range that's present within the order and movement's armoury of practice to complete spiritual benefit. You can go all the way with what we've got. There's no need to go more widely. Perhaps it's important that a few do for the reasons that I've given, that the expansion of the range of the order and movement. But I think the great majority have no need to, and probably would be better not. In the modern day, our great danger is distraction. We live in a world in which choice is the main good, so to speak. We feel that what we're owed is a wide range of possibility. If you've ever been to a bagel shop in New York, you'll know what I mean. It's a moment of intense paralysis. Even getting breakfast in America is frightening. Well, we tend to think everything should be like that. We should have a wide range of choice. And by and large, all it does is feed our restlessness and craving. And probably most of us just need to stick to a few simple things which we go into very deeply. It was an important principle of Bhante's very early on in the creation of the movement. More and more of less and less. Or is it less and less of more and more? No, more and more of less and less. I've got to get that right. More and more of less and less. Now remember that when Bhante started to talk about this, and it was really at the beginning of the whole sort of emphasis on not shopping around. In the early days of my ordination, at the centre that we had then, the one centre we had then at Archway, there were notice boards. And on those notice boards, there was just about every Buddhist group advertising that was available in England at that time, all five of them. And not only all the Buddhist groups, but all the various kinds of New Age alternative lookalikes, as it were. And Bhante one day asked us, well, why are they there? And we sort of mumbled and muttered. And he said, well, do you know what they're like? You know, you're in effect recommending those to people. Do you know what they're like? And, you know, are you necessarily sort of suggesting to people that they go along to something that you think is a good thing? And then he went on to say that, anyway, is it a good thing that people do get sort of scattered over a wide range of different practices, different groups, and so on? And he said that at that time he felt that most people needed, above all, to concentrate. They needed to get down to something. They could very easily just float from group to group and never really get anywhere. And so he said that we needed to concentrate more and more on less and less. Just a few basic teachings deeply understood are really what you need, all you need. And that probably goes for most of us. The whole discussion about taking on teachings and practices from outside the order should not distract us from the central responsibility that we have for deeply exploring and understanding simple basic teachings. Yes, I think that until you're really quite deeply imbued in those simple basic teachings, you would be ill-advised to explore more widely. Take a practice and stick to it. Of course, you may gain inspiration and clarity from other sources, even on those basic practices. Sometimes reading or even listening to people talk about mindfulness of breathing that come from other traditions can refresh and inspire your practice of mindfulness of breathing. But yes, one needs to be very careful of restlessness and distractedness. And I think that you shouldn't feel bad if you just plod on with the basics. If you aren't shopping around, or if you aren't looking around at other teachings and practices, you shouldn't now feel that you're, you know, unfashionable and you really had better go and find a teacher from outside the order and movement before you're left behind. There's absolutely no need, there's no necessity, but at the same time, it may be a good thing for some to do so. That's really the point that we want to make. And I hope that I've at least given an overview of the field and given some basis for discussion. And be very interested to hear what you make of what I've said and the way that I've said it. I'm sure there's much that's not sufficiently clear or not sufficiently explicit. I must say for myself that I have always read widely, and I've always found that very inspiring and in a sense sort of refreshing. But I found that the basic practices that are available to me within the order have always stood me in good stead, and I've not felt a great need to go beyond the order. Once or twice in my spiritual life I have wondered whether I was really getting what I needed, and I have begun to sort of think, well, you know, maybe, you know, if I belong to a different order, or but I've come to think in time that that was not really the case. It seemed like it at the time, but it wasn't really the case. It was simply a question of making a deeper spiritual commitment within the context of what was already available to me. And I've myself not felt that need. So, I hope that I've both reinforced the importance of just sticking to what one's got, and of more and more and less and less, but at the same time affirm the value for some people of looking more widely, but doing so on a very firm and solid basis.